Hi, this is Mike Spivey of the Spivey Consulting Group. It is Tuesday, March 2nd, I believe. Is that right, Dave? March 2nd?
It is. It's March 2nd. The month of March is here in like a lion.
Ides of March. I am joined with Dave Killoran, the CEO of PowerScore. And today, I think...
Hey, Mike.
Good to see you, as always.
Same.
Right. We see each other a little bit differently these days.
Truly.
Over a phone. We're going to be talking about, I believe, we'll talk some about this cycle, particularly as it relates to maybe any upcoming movement. But then we're going to focus specifically on what might happen next cycle. How's that sound with you, Dave?
That sounds great to me. I think let's get an overview and kind of like catch everybody up on where things have been going so far and where they might go next year as well.
Sure. And would you like for me to give that overview?
I would. Let's start off with like the opener here, because this current cycle is a little bit crazy. I think it's unusual in terms of my history with the LSAT and law school admissions, but I think your career is a little bit longer in terms of the admission side. Tell me what you're seeing, and have you ever seen anything like this before?
Yeah, so the answer is I've seen things like this before in terms of number of applicants. In fact, I've seen things where there were more applicants, but I've never seen anything like the score distribution at the 165 plus. Yeah, you know that very well. And what that's doing is obviously it's creating a tremendous amount of bottleneck, slowness, more denials with people with strong numbers. I was just on the phone this weekend with someone with a 173, 3.72, who has yet to, it's been all denials.
Huh.
With no character and fitness issue. And that's not just that's not like one person. So there's lots of people, you know this as well as I do, there's lots of people this cycle with scores in the 165 plus to 180 range who are not going to get admitted to schools that we would have seen them admitted to in the last 20 years. So to answer the question directly, I've never seen something like that before. This is the most competitive cycle. And the problem, Dave, is when you're competitive at the top, it dominoes down throughout the entire stream. So if they're taking less people, it allows people, a notch below to take less people, so forth, so on. So you're just not seeing nearly as many as admits as you normally would.
Yeah, I think I saw a Spivey Consulting tweet that I found really interesting where you said there are enough 165 plus scores to fill every single seat in the top 50 law schools. And when I read that, I was like, I was vaguely aware of the obvious fact that there's a lot more LSAT scores, but I hadn't thought about it in that particular kind of scenario. And would you say that that's contributing to the slowness that we're seeing with a lot of these admits and wait lists and so far?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that's the only contributing factor. I think some of the signaling from the people who put on the test also maybe have contributed a little bit to schools being uncertain what's going to happen. But I would say the primary contributing factor is that fact. The other thing, Dave, to keep note of is that tweet we tweeted was 2 weeks ago. And we're not going to be, erasing people with 165s and above. Or as Justin Kane, my business intelligence analyst, said, it's not like Thanos is going to get all six Infinity Stones, snap his finger, and get rid of half the applicants. So while percentages may go down, the aggregate number of 165 plus scores are going to go up for the rest of the summer.
Yeah, let me interject here for a second, because there may be some people listening who are not entirely certain what we're talking about with like what could be called the score bubble, although I know you don't like the word bubble.
I just don't understand its meaning. I can only think of popping bubbles when you say that.
Well, this is a bubble that will slowly deflate, as I'm sure we'll come back to. But one of the things that we see in law school admissions this year is that the number of total applicants is up. It's about up about 20%. And the number of LSAT scores is also up. There's about 16% more LSAT scores this year. However, it's a really weird distribution. It is not even across the 120 to 180 spectrum. What you're seeing is that there is a huge surplus of numbers in the upper register. So, for example, you think there's 16.3% more LSAT scores this year. However, in the scores from 170 to 180, there are 62.9% more scores. So there are far more high scores than just overall scores. And that's really the bubble that we're talking about. When you go from 155 on down, the numbers actually are less than last year. And so what we've seen in the last year or so is a greater number of overall scores on the upper side than on the lower side. And that's creating this pressure that you're talking about, in part at least.
So I have a question for you about that. We've seen that all cycle long, and we've known about the unequal distribution of bandwidths all cycle long. Although some people have admitted to it more than others. Why do you think that is, Dave? Why is the, I mean, the distribution is so anomalistic. I'm curious your sort of take on that.
That's a good question. And I would say, to your credit and a little bit to ours, we have both been sounding that drum for a while, that we've been seeing numbers that are out of alignment. And if you go back in the timeline, it's certainly part of it is caused by the fact that there are more applicants. But as my example just kind of showed, that still doesn't account for all these high scores. But there was a big change in the middle of all this. Obviously, the pandemic hit and they canceled an LSAT in the spring of last year. And then we had the May 2020 LSAT come out, except that it was a totally new kind of LSAT. It was the LSAT Flex. They dropped two of the sections, so it was now just three sections. All of them were scored, and you took it at home. And I think that the idea that they had when they put that test together was this will be a perfect substitute. And I think it's a great substitute. As I've said on the PowerScore LSAT podcast, I think that what they did in hindsight is rather amazing, that they were able to transport this test online within basically 2 months or so. I think it's an incredible achievement. The thing, though, is it's not the same test. It's only three sections. There's one less section of logical reasoning. And really, kind of a very compelling thing about it is you take it at home. You're sitting in the comfort of your home. You don't have to get up that morning and go to a test center. You also don't have to take it in the morning. You can take it at 5 o'clock in the afternoon if that's what's best for you.
Can you get like a friend to massage your shoulders while you're taking it, or is that against the...
You can do that both before and after the test. Okay, not, all right, but you cannot do it during the test.
Fair enough.
I would like that, though. That would be the great way to take the LSAT right. While someone's just giving me a massage. In fact, it would probably be detrimental to my score.
You're like someone's hiding under the desk with a Dr. Pepper, and you say, shot, and they're like, you know, there's a straw.
You're taking this in a strange way, Mike, somebody hiding under the table right. While taking the LSAT.
Right, we'll shift back to professional direction.
Thank you. but I would say that ultimately what happened was is that there were a number of factors that contributed to people doing better on the test. Do I think the test itself in terms of content and question difficulty changed? No. In fact, as we know from studying this test over the years, they are reusing non-disclosed exams that go back a year to even 10, 12 years. And so they're using the same kinds of questions that they have always used. Nothing has changed there, but the environment in which you take the test and the physical length of the test is so different that I think that created an opportunity for people to really do well on this. And so that, to me, is a lot of what is causing that so-called score rise in the upper 165, 170 and up levels.
So you think it's environmental, state-dependent learning, more sort of freedom and less anxiety versus... When I took the GMAT, I was crammed in a room of 30 people and the marching band was playing below us. So obviously it's a less stressful, well, not for everyone, but probably for most people, it's a less stress-inducing environment. And you don't think it has to do with the scaling of the test?
I don't think it has to do with the scaling per se. The first factor is clearly the way the test has changed. The second is that the pandemic created an environment where more people were able to study for greater lengths of time and more intensively. So that's a 1-2 punch that's pretty dramatic in the sense of, hey, the test got physically easier. It's only 3 sections now. And also, I had a lot more time to study in the run-up to it. Right away, those two things would suggest that you'd see a score rise. The scaling question is one that I know you and I have talked about a lot over the past year. And my firm opinion here is that they got the scaling a bit wrong in the early days of this test. I think they were a little bit too loose. And there's only one actual scale that we have seen. That was the May 2020 LSAT that was released in the fall of last year. And when I saw that scale, I will be honest, my jaw dropped. It was a little bit looser than we predicted by one question at the 170 level. But going down through it, we wrote a blog about it and talk about how historically loose that scale is. And I was like, why would you create an environment where you actually have a very loose scale on a test like this where everything else has changed really for the positive? So I think what happened initially was that they thought this is just another LSAT. They put a regular scale on it and they didn't realize that the other factors that I've been talking about, such as the length of the test and studying more, would actually counter that. And I think they've learned. And the scales got a little bit tighter, in my opinion, at least, and became a little bit more accurate. Because when we saw the January results come out, it looked normal to me. There wasn't that bubble at the top that those extra scores. It was just pretty, it was relatively normal compared to what we've expected pre-pandemic and pre-LSAT flex.
Yeah. I'll quote a dean of a law school, and then I'll get off the scaling. The bug I have about the scaling, it doesn't, there's 6 or 7 hypotheses on why that there might be this uneven distribution. It doesn't matter, no matter what the hypothesis is, whether it's state-dependent learning or more time or more study time, someone should have accounted for that.
It's hard to make the argument that that's wrong. Okay. When the May LSAT came out, you would have thought that the initial reaction would be like, maybe we need to think about readjusting this further. And I think they have calibrated it. They're smart. They continue to do this. I'm just not sure they reacted as quickly. And that probably is because they may not have thought the pandemic was going to last. They might have thought we'll have to do this for maybe 1, 2, 3 times.
Right.
Because if you recall, at that point in time, they were announcing LSATs like 6 weeks before they got administered.
Right.
And then they started announcing 2 of them at a time, and then it expanded a little bit more. But they were in a mode where it's like, this is going to go away quick. But it didn't. And I know you have certainly had a lot to say about the scale. And to be honest, I've agreed 100% with what you said about it. So we're not on different pages.
Yeah, it's by my estimation, it's unnaturally messed with market decisions. So, and by market decisions, I mean people's, what their aspirations are. And I talk to those people every day. So I'm a little more cranked up over this than, normally I'm kind of, well, I'm not chill, but I'm pretty cranked up about this because I talk to people who put a lot of time into their scores who are not getting any admits. And I know the people listening to this, a lot can relate to that statement. So we'll leave it at that. But I just want to know, and I know you feel the same thing. That's why we like each other. I feel for these people. I really do. And, there's a lot of people who are not getting expectations relative to what they went into the cycle. And I think if more people had signaled to the market, hey, this is going to be a tough cycle, maybe some of these people could have cast a wider net.
Yeah, because they have expectations based upon past years of thinking, I have these scores, this GPA, I probably should get into this school. And what they're seeing is, at best, they're getting a wait list with those numbers now. It is really frustrating. And it would have been nice if we'd had more information earlier on. At when we got it when they finally released it. And we both, you and I, had a conversation at that point where we were like stunned by the numbers right. that we saw at that point.
Right.
But talking about those applicants right now, we know it's a slow cycle so far. Obviously, we've reached that point where a lot of people are, if they're not admitted, they're getting waitlisted. And that puts them kind of in this limbo. So, speaking of a difficult cycle so far, how do you see things for people who are currently on a wait list?
Yeah, I mean, let me preface this by who knows. Like, what I'm going to say probably isn't going to be optimistic for many people, but I also am certain that I could be wrong about many things that I predict going forward the rest of my life. What I would expect is as follows. What we call waitlist movement and admissions is summer melting. And the reason why we call that is because a school like Harvard and let's just add a few schools, Stanford, Yale, Columbia, NYU, let's say in aggregate, they take 1,000 people off the waitlist. That obviously, of those 1,000, let's pretend 800 accept the offer off the waitlist. Those people are leaving like Penn in Michigan, et cetera. You get the point. And then Penn and Michigan have to take people. And then, you know, and then Duke and UVA are losing people. And it's just one big domino effect. And every time there's a wave, not every time because I hate absolutes, but most often when there's a wave, that you, that same domino effect happens. Now, it can start at the top or, you know, it can – Vanderbilt can take 100 people off the wait list, and then Emory has to start taking people because, right. The problem this cycle is what I would anticipate, Dave, and this, again, this is not going to be optimistic, but I don't think we're going to see many of those waves. I mean, just look at 165 and plus. I mean, schools are going to be so populated and so comfortable above their, keep in mind, it's medians, not averages. So if you're 43 people above, you know, on your seat deposits above your one, if you're Harvard and you have a 174 this year, which seems like it's very possible looking at their sort of footprint, and you have 55 people or 85 people in your class above that, and meaning you would have to lose 86 to go to a 173. You know, I'm not speaking for Harvard. I'm just speaking hypothetics, but there's not really a need to go to the wait list. So I think we'll see some small waves throughout the summer. I think some of these waves won't be triggered at the top. So they'll start at schools maybe in the 164, 163 range and then trickle down. But it's not going to be like the go-go years where, you know, it was just wave after wave of admits. When I was in admissions at Vanderbilt at the beginning of my career, we would make waitlist admits all summer long because the schools above us would be taking our matriculates and our seat deposits all summer long. Where I can't imagine a scenario, although I could be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. But I don't see a scenario where there's just this, you know, weekly waitlist admitting going on this summer.
So they'll still use the wait list. They just won't use it to the extent perhaps that we've seen in prior years.
I think the way I would word it is I've never in my 21 years of doing this, I've never seen a year where there's no wait list movement. But there'll probably be less wait list movement, particularly at the top 30, whatever, 35, 40 schools than I've seen in my 21 years. But I hope I'm wrong.
I hope you're wrong, too.
We agree on a lot of things, but that one I strongly agree on.
Always, I'm always happy to agree and say I hope you're wrong about something.
Right, so. Exactly. Well, you must be a happy person then.
No, we've agreed all year long. So on that particular count, every time you and I talk, it's the same conversation because we're both like, yeah, agree, right, same. Right. My view too.
Right. Some of which we can't say on this podcast.
No, that's definitely the case. So do you want to talk about the upcoming year then? You know, we've looked at the cycle so far. We've looked at the wait list for what we might see over the next couple of months. you guys do a prediction blog every year about like what the upcoming cycle is going to look like. And I always find it invaluable to read. It's always right, in my opinion. You guys are always spot on with that. You were right again this year about it being kind of like a slower, longer cycle with more applicants. So what do you see, not for this cycle, but then for the next cycle, for the people who are going to be applying in this fall?
Well, so let me just return the favor, because part of that is going to be what happens with the LSAT. And I know we talked a little bit about your assessment that they'll get more refined in how they scale it with more data. That's natural and that's understandable. And I understand that LSAC didn't have any data for the LSAT Flex going into it to scale it. You're the go-to expert for, you know, LSAT. I think you have the most, tell me if I'm wrong, but you have the most popular LSAT podcast out there.
I believe we do, yes.
And probably the most popular LSAT books.
Also the case, yes. Thank you.
Also, you email me a schedule to write an admissions book from time to time, and I never hit the schedule.
One of these days, we'll get the admissions book out and up and running.
If we don't do a 2.5 hour podcast, that would be helpful, probably. So in August, things change, correct?
Yes.
What's going to happen?
You know, let's talk about the LSAT, and then we'll come back to that question, because maybe knowing what's going to happen with the LSAT will help kind of shape everyone's understanding of what's going to happen with the admissions cycle. So if you look at what's happened over the last year, I mean, worldwide, it's been a period of uncertainty, but certainly in the LSAT world, it's been a tremendous period of uncertainty. The Flex comes in. We don't know when certain exams are going to be held. We don't know if the Flex is going to stay or change. Relatively recently, though, we finally got clarity going forward. And this period of uncertainty, this period of the LSAT Flex itself is going to end. The next two LSATs in April and June are both in the LSAT Flex format. And if you're coming to this for the first time, just briefly, that's only three sections, one of logical reasoning, logic games, and reading comprehension. All three sections count. There is no break, and it's on a 120 to 180 scoring scale. That ends starting in August. But it doesn't end entirely. What they're doing is they're actually just changing it slightly. When the August LSAT comes up, it is still going to be online, at home. There are still going to be three scored sections, one of each type. However, they're going to add a new fourth section. And really, you could say they're going to add it back in. This fourth section is going to be an experimental section, which probably sounds ominous to some people. But what it really means in test parlance is that you are going to have an unscored section, one of which is logical reasoning, logic games, or reading comprehension. So some people out there will take LSATs with two logical reasonings, other people will take LSATs with two logic games, and other people will take LSATs with two reading comprehensions. And that's adding in more test-taking time. It's an additional 35 minutes. Now, to offset one of the big problems, which is the need to go to the bathroom, amazingly enough, they are putting in a break of up to 10 minutes between sections 2 and 3. And so as we look at that going forward, one of the things that's going to do on the LSAT is it's going to drive scores lower. When you have a three-section test, it's over and done so quickly. You know, an hour and a half later, and you're out of there. Now we're going to be stretching this test out a little bit longer. And one of the things that we have seen is that fatigue makes a difference. I don't know for sure what they're going to do, but I would bet that the experimental section will very frequently be one of the first three sections, meaning that in almost all cases, the fourth section is going to be scored, meaning that when you're at your most fatigued, you are then going to be taking questions that count.
It's interesting. Doesn't knowing that going in, if you know that going in, doesn't that help though? Like you have your 5 hour energy shot right before the fourth section.
You should go take it at the break and power up for the last two sections. And experimental is nothing new. I've seen some students online complain about, I can't believe they're making us into guinea pigs. And of course, the reason for an experimental is they pretest items to be used on future LSATs. They have to make sure that the questions have test integrity and are viable. And so they need to test them. And they did this 4 years. There's been an experimental for as long as I can remember on this test. And it's very common on the GMAT and GRE. Experimental questions appear there as well, even on tests like the SAT. So this is something that is standard in the standardized test-taking industry. They just got away from it. in the last year. But what that caused a problem for them was they started to run out of tests to reuse. There's only a limited supply. It's not like they have 1,000 tests sitting there to use. And as they began to run out, we started predicting, at least on the PowerScore podcast, that they had to make a format change to add back in the experimental. That is exactly what we're seeing at this point. So it's not a surprise that they're doing this, and I'm really glad that they've announced it. But the important thing to understand is this may start in August, and they may have released all the test dates through June of 2022, but this isn't going away then. This is the test for the next several years. And that's actually a really welcome thing on one sense, because it means that we are now in a period of stability. We understand what the next several years are going to look like. How that affects scores, though, is a longer test with more uncertainty will probably drive scores back towards that normal curve. And so that means that those, that big bubble, to use that word you hate, of 170 type scores, that's out. That's going to disappear. And I think there's a second thing that happens too. I mean, we're all learning machines, and LSAC is an organization that learns. And I think they now understand the scaling a little bit better and how the at-home environment and the shorter test actually affected the outcomes. And I'm sure they'll make the appropriate adjustments. I know they care. I've talked to them frequently about this. They want to get it right. Their interests are to be, you know, as transparent as they can be given what they do. But they have said repeatedly, you know, we're always striving to make this as good as a test as possible. So I think they're going to be studying that very carefully. So I think the scores will return to the normal, and it'll still be on the 120-180 scale, which brings up a secondary point. For anyone who's concerned, well, did if I took a flex or one of these tests, does it make a difference? It does not. Law schools will treat them all the same. And the name is going to be dropped. It will no longer be LSAT Flex. It's just going back to the LSAT. So this flex period is over, but no one's going to hold it against you that you took a flex test. They don't care.
Let me chime in there. What law schools care about is not whether it's LSAT Flex or LSAT. I know this has come up a lot online. It's not even the raw score that they care about. It's the raw score relative to what their competition is bringing in.
Yeah.
If you're raw, look, if you're Yale and your raw score is a 150, but everyone else is a 135, then you're doing great. They don't care.
Yeah, you don't care.
Right. So it's all relative based on what's going on with your surrounding cohort.
Yeah, I think there's this perception that admissions professionals are sitting there like, oh, this was a 175 on the flex. It doesn't count as much. No, they're sitting there saying, this is a 175. Yay, let's move on.
Right.
And I mean, they don't care about the flex.
Each school gets a regression equation that correlates your LSAT plus GPA with bar passage. So I shouldn't have given that 140 example because schools would care because that would correlate with lower bar passage. Right, which again, people who get a 140 pass the bar, but so schools have a floor that they, based on their regression equation, that they look at. You know, I often say that it doesn't, like a score one below the median is, people obsess with 25ths and 75ths, and they're almost meaningless numbers. Because it's median, again, it's medians, not averages. So if you have if your median is a 165 and someone comes in with a 164, but someone else comes in with a 161, it's almost no different to the school. I don't know how else to say it. I just like to be transparent. But there is a floor. Maybe that floor is a 152 where you start seeing people drop off dramatically on the bar passage at your school. So at your school, the 152 is where the bar, and that's where they start caring. About. Does that make sense?
Totally.
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, you get into a certain point where it's hard to say exactly what'll happen, but the idea of floors and we don't think you're going to pass the bar based upon our history and knowledge, that's crystal clear.
Right. Right.
So, but let's take this back. You know, we just talked about the LSAT and the fact that LSAT scores should return to normal over time. That doesn't mean there still aren't a bunch out there that are going to be high next year. But we were talking about the prediction blog and how accurate that's been over time. Knowing what we know about the LSAT returning to standard stable means, what do you see happening in the next cycle?
Yeah. So thank you for the prediction blog compliment. We put a lot of effort into it. I will say this. The only reason it was close to accurate this past year is our picture on it was a dog in a tie sitting at a computer – with a bunch of airplanes dropping bombs on cities in the background, which was our prediction for this cycle. So I guess we kind of got that right. Next cycle is interesting. So let me start at the end. Let me just start with a punchline. It's going to be a very competitive cycle unless Big Law, when the numbers come out, froze up their hiring entirely, which I don't think is going to happen. And the reason why I add that caveat is I haven't just done admissions in my career. I was a dean of career services right when the Great Recession happened. Year one of Great Recession, application spike. But then Big Law stopped hiring, just literally like almost stopped. It was just horrible to watch. And then year two, applications fell off the cliff downward. So if that were to replicate, I would expect history to replicate. And I would expect there actually to be, in other words, people don't want to go to law school if they see that there's no jobs opening. So I don't think that's going to happen, incidentally. So I think next cycle is going to be a very competitive cycle for a number of reasons I'll get into. It's not going to be as you allude to, a much more smooth distribution of LSAT scores. So while we may see a similar number of applicants, I don't think we're going to see the same level of hyper competitiveness, because I don't think there's just going to be this, like, you know, I don't think that the castles at the top of the hill are going to pull up their drawbridges like they have this year. That's always my analogy. I don't know where I got that from.
It's reading, very medieval.
I read tons of fantasy books when I was a child. So what's going to happen next cycle is this. You're going to have, let's say, 10% carryover of 165 and plus scores. They don't get the schools they want. That is problematic, because the aggregate number of even 10% carryover from this cycle to the next is a large number, which fine points how many freaking 165 plus scores there are this year, right? If 10% is a large number, that means 90% sticking around this cycle is a huge number. Which, again, I emphasize this because not everyone this year has been emphasizing that fact.
Well, if you were to look just at 165 to 180 and take 10% of what we have, you'd be talking about something over 1,100 additional people into the next cycle.
And something like that will happen. Obviously, we don't know if it'll be 10% or 8% or 12%, but something like that is going to happen. I actually did a poll on Reddit yesterday because I was curious how many – I was really curious in the – I said how many people are playing this cycle, next cycle, but I was really curious in the both cycle department, because we're trying to get a feel for how many people are going to carry over when we do our prediction blog this summer, which will be hopefully a little more exacting. So probably what's going to happen is there's going to be some economic recovery. I know I just said like an economic drought would decrease admissions tremendously, but an economic recovery will also decrease applicant numbers some, because people will take jobs instead of applying to law school. So yeah. What I think is going to happen is we're going to have slightly less applicants and a much smoother distribution. So keeping with the smooth analogy, it's going to be smoother sailing, but the seas are still going to be choppy. Like the 2010s are gone. The go-go years of admissions are gone. They're not gone forever. So if you're 8 years old and you're listening to this podcast, don't freak out. But in the next year, I don't think we're going to return to anything that's like remotely like it was two cycles ago, where, yeah, you know, you could sneeze and get a swag from a school. It's just not going to happen like that. I'm going to get the amount of hate emails I get from schools after this podcast is going to be astronomical.
Nah, they can't be upset about this. These are facts, man. I guess what you're saying, and I'll summarize it for anybody listening, is that it is still going to be competitive next year. Is it going to be as competitive as this year? No, it'll be a little bit less. Is it going to be as, I'll say, relatively easy as we saw 2-3 years ago? No, it'll be harder than that. And so this is kind of like a little bit less than what we're into currently, but still a little bit more competitive than prior years. You think that's a fair assessment?
It is. And we even have a leading indicator of this. A group of deans, I think in California, asked the ABA if they could delay submitting their employment data. Now, I can't say for certain what that means, but I have having lived the decanal life, that what that probably means is their employment numbers aren't what they want them to be. So I think that the market's going to see employment numbers that are worse than normal. And I think that probably the economy will also improve over the summer. So I think we're going to have a easier cycle, but easy is a rough word to use. We're going to have a less competitive cycle next year than we had this year. I actually think if I had to make a guess, Dave, I would guess. And what's the expression that I love so much that I read? Like, no sophistication of your past will allay the fact that you know nothing about the future. But I would guess this will be that this cycle will go down in my career as the most difficult cycle that I'll have ever seen.
It's been, at least as far as I've been doing this, I'd have to say it's been the most challenging, if certainly one of the most challenging, which is heartbreaking for a lot of the students that I know who have stellar numbers.
Exactly.
And had high expectations based upon what they saw as prior medians. And you talked about medians before, and, you know, Harvard's median, how much will it go up? Will it go up a point or 2 points? I personally think they're such a big school that I could see a point, but some of the smaller schools at the top, they may see 2 point jumps. Who knows? I have one other question, though, that I've gotten a lot in recent weeks, and it comes down to deferrals. I also was going to ask you about the economy, but you kind of talked about that, so I think we're covered there. We know that some people, because of the pandemic and virtual schooling, decided to delay attending. They deferred for a year. Do you see this as a factor that affects, you know, the current year and the next year, or is it really just a wash and not that big of a deal?
Well, I think deferrals impacted this cycle, making it even more difficult. Well, right, so Harvard went remote and they took a bunch of deferrals, and that so they already started off the cycle with a large number of deferrals. I can't remember the exact number. At some point I did, because they told me. I don't think it's going to impact next cycle as much, because I suspect, Dave, that having talked to a lot of people who are, you know, getting their admits this cycle are understandably thrilled. I got a direct message on Twitter. Hey, put a pin on that. I want to ask you about direct messages. I got a direct message on Twitter this morning from a client of ours who was admitted to Yale, and he was just, you know, thrilled beyond belief. Now, obviously, Yale doesn't have people push off to the next cycle anyways. I think the people that get admitted this cycle are going to say, the heck with waiting, I'm going to law school. So psychologically, my guess is there's going to be less deferrals that carry over to next cycle, which would be another reason why next cycle won't be as competitive as this cycle.
I'd agree with you on that in part as well, because from a social and societal standpoint, people are getting more used to being on Zoom and in Zoom classes and in these type of meetings. And so at first it was like, wait, I have to go to school this way? This is going to be terrible. Now, a year later, people are like, this is the new reality for at least a while longer. It's not going to last 3 years. I'm just going to go ahead and go to school. And I don't think they're going to defer at the rate that we just saw last year.
Well, the other thing is, I think every school this coming fall will be in person versus remote. My new hobby is talking to epidemiologists and virologists. It's the most fascinating stuff in the world. But I highly suspect, I mean, schools want to be in person. They very much want it. I've yet to talk to a dean of a law school who has said, oh, I'd rather be remote. So I think that unless, you know, some sort of like further mutation occurs with the virus, I think every school will be in person in the fall.
I certainly hope so, because that's the way to go to school. That's really, I think, the best way to interact. And one of the great benefits of law school is making those connections in person and carrying those with you throughout your professional life thereafter. And it hurts when you don't get that opportunity.
Right. So. And class sizes will probably be a little larger next cycle. I've mentioned this a number of times, but for people who haven't heard it, law schools were essentially underwritten by central universities ever since the Great Recession. So what was happening is they were giving more and more what people would, I don't refer to as merit aid, I refer to as remission, but that's very nuanced. They were giving more and more merit aid out every cycle. And that was being because their central universities were giving them money to do so every year. Well, what's happened with central universities? They're in a horrible financial crisis right now. I mean, Moody's downgraded them as an investment for the, I think, the first time ever. You know, when you don't have room and board, people don't realize this. Colleges and universities are the largest hotels in the world. And they make tons off of room and board and food and activity fees and stuff like that. So they had all of that freeze up, all that money freeze up. Instead of giving money, law schools money, it's more likely that central universities are going to be asking law schools for money. Hey, it's your turn to contribute. So how do law schools make money? It's off of students. It's revenue.
Yep.
Right. So next cycle, I think we're going to see larger class sizes, which means more admits.
I'm glad we got to that point, because that's the one, another really positive factor for next year is with all these applicants, you expect to see that. You expect to see a rise, especially if they can maintain their numbers or even have like kind of like the unicorn scenario where they increase their numbers and increase their medians.
Right.
That would be a, you know, something that economically would be hugely advantageous for them. Not typically possible for them to do, but that would really make a big difference in the whole situation.
Yeah, for a law school, that is the unicorn scenario. You bring in 50 more students and you go up plus two LSAT. What I think is going to happen is I mean, people have been predicting this since the Gorman report, which no one listening know. Do you know what that is? Do you remember that?
Of course I do,
yes. Okay, yeah, okay. So let me tell you, this is actually worth the listeners hearing. This is how stupid that ranking was. It ranked you in like four categories. I don't know. This is in the 1980s. I was like, you know, throwing a ball against the side of the wall of my house.
A long time ago.
Right. But it would rank you in four categories, like admissions, employment, faculty, and resources. But here's how ridiculous it was. Let's say you're Starfleet Academy. I'm not going to use a school name for once. If you were ranked number 15 overall, you were ranked number 15 in admissions, number 15 in employment, number 15 in faculty, and number 15 in resources. So as much as we sort of like poke fun of U.S. News and World Report and as many holes there are in U.S. News and World Report, it's not nearly as bad as the Gorman Report. Any Reddit or other person listening to this podcast could develop a better ranking system than the Gorman Report.
Yeah.
Back to the point at hand, I think we're going to see some schools have to get off the ranking carousel.
Because, that's a tough ask.
Yeah, but they've been, the way they've stayed on that carousel is from support from Central University.
So they're just going to have to basically throw the towel in on keeping whatever standard it is that kept them with their ranking.
Correct. Correct. I foresee that in the future. I think a lot of law schools are going to fight it tooth and nail, And the deans of the law schools are going to fight it tooth and nail. And there's going to be a lot of intense meetings between provosts and deans. But at the end of the day, some schools aren't going to be able to afford it.
You know, my personal opinion is that would be fantastic on a lot of levels, because I really hate the rankings. I hate the way they drive the whole, I guess you could say, the industry, the law schools themselves, into this kind of like zero-sum battle where it's me against you versus who's best for our institution. And that's a really black and white statement. I realize law schools are like, we're still trying to take people who are best for our institution. But we all know the reality is that if you're applying to a top-level school and you have a 155 LSAT, you have the steepest possible mountain to climb. And a lot of that is everything else in your background may be amazing, but because of that one number or, you know, even a low GPA, the school is already behind the eight ball in terms of trying to take you because they know it'll affect them and they'll have to offset it somehow. So I would love to see a decrease of the influence of the rankings. Although I know you and U.S. News and World Report are all on really good terms and are good friends.
They love me. I talk to their general counsel once a year. I want to add, he's a really good guy. He's a really friendly
guy. I'm sure he is. Yeah. For those of you who don't know what I'm referring to, Spivey Consulting for years was able to pre-release, also leak the rankings that were coming out each year. And I think you did that, and it was always the exact rankings. And then one year, U.S. News and World Report sent you a cease and desist letter and said, you need to stop that. Although they didn't have any legal basis for it, I think they called upon your ethics and said, please stop doing it for ethical reasons.
Yeah, I mean, so I talked to 7 lawyers that day, and all of them said, when the letter starts off with ethics, it means they don't really have any legal recourse. I'll tell you one funny side story about the whole rankings leak that we were able to do for something like 8 straight years. I mean, keep in mind, I got them for like 18 straight years because I got them when I was in law schools. Amazing. If you want to control leaks, just don't send 200 law schools the rankings a day early. Right?
A lot of organizations could learn that. Maybe don't send a couple thousand pre-law advisors updates if you don't want them to get into the hands of other people who are professionals.
Right. So an interesting side story is U.S. News and World Report. I guess this is pro forma. I thought it was kind of ridiculous. They asked me who is it Spivey that's handing you this leak every year? And my response, I think aptly, rightly so, was you'd have to ask me who wasn't sending me these rankings to get a shorter list. Because, that's it fine points to your point about how much people dislike the rankings.
Oh, yeah. They put it out there immediately and everybody complains about it. And then at the end of the day, they're all kind of like adhering to those particular standards because a rankings drop can have a material financial effect on a law school and nobody wants to see a rankings drop. So,
yeah, rankings impact behavior.
Yeah.
There's no better, it's a very concrete way to say it, but it impacts behavior. Students get a little bit more upset if they're, like I saw once a mutiny at Emory Law one year, they had a town hall meeting about the rankings after they had a keg party. Like the school hosted a keg.
Idea.
The school hosted a keg party every Friday. They called it something. And then they had the town hall about their 5-point plummet in the rankings. Like, horrible idea. Horrible.
Keg
idea.
Party is a good idea. Meeting after a keg party, bad idea.
Yeah, to break bad news to the students. anything else that we didn't cover? I did want to ask you about that one thing that I said to put a pin in.
You know, as far as the cycle, I think we've covered it all. I feel pretty comfortable with what we've done currently and what's coming up in the next cycle. The LSAT, I think I've hopefully covered that pretty well. If anybody has questions, feel free to reach out to me. I'm available on our LSAT forum, on Twitter, you name it, even on our blog and so forth. But you did say something. You put a pin in something about Twitter.
You just said it. You said, feel free to reach out to me. This is, people can tune out if they want. This is neither here nor there. We had this world famous psychologist. I mean, he's like the leading psychologist in the world. He's done 3 TED Talks. And he and I chit-chatted for 10 minutes before we got on our recorded podcast. And I meant to ask him this question because I know he gets it infinitely more than you and I get it. But we get it a ton. I get about 350 messages a day. Hmm. How do you handle responding to those? Because I haven't figured out a good system yet.
There isn't one. I try to respond to as many as I can. But I have realized over the years that there just reaches a point where I can't, because it's little pieces of time over and over again. And usually if I see something where I know I've answered the question elsewhere, like maybe I answered it in a podcast or maybe I wrote a blog about it or I replied to somebody online, I'll try to make really fast replies that direct people to those. And sometimes it's really basic. I've been getting a lot of questions recently about upcoming LSAT dates. And I'm like, they are on the LSAC website. You don't need to ask me. But at the same time, it's very flattering to me to get messages. I think it is a signal to me, at least, that, hey, you're approachable And I think that's the way that it should be. I mean, one of the things about teaching the LSAT is that you really have to be kind of like personable about it. You want to see what students are doing. I like to hear the feedback of what people have to say, especially about our courses or our books, because it helps us improve and it helps us to know what's resonating or what we need to do more of. You know, right. You and I have both spent a lot of time recently focusing on the mental positivity, mental health aspect of what we do, as well as the world at large. And that's, on at least on my side, been largely driven by the messages that I've gotten from students. But to go specifically to your question, I'm not able to answer them all. I try to answer as many as possible. And if I've corresponded with somebody before, I'll try to see if I'm able to do it. But it is not something where I'm able to get through all of them at this point. And in our podcast recently, we made a very clear signal to people that said we're not going to be able to answer as many questions over the next couple of months because we're working on a new LSAT course.
Right.
And that is incredibly time consuming. So I don't have a really good answer for you. I wish I could say, well, what you do is you separate them into four quartiles of priority. I don't do it that way. I see messages. I like to check them out and see if I can respond. Sometimes I don't understand the message, in which case that's probably not going to get a response. It also depends on the channel. If people send me messages on LinkedIn, I don't go there. And I tend not to spend a lot of time because it's always, hey, do you want help with your marketing? Or, do you want to increase sales 10%? Whereas on Twitter, I tend to be a little bit more responsive. So
okay.
It's a matter of the medium, but there is no good answer, at least from me, man. I'm sorry.
For me, it's dependent on the day. And unfortunately, and I apologize if there's any listeners still listening, which is probably like we're down to five listeners. I apologize to those five people if I don't. My schedule is becoming more and more such that I have more days I can't respond to messages than I can. I used to be more responsive, so I feel guilty. I appreciate you always answering the phone when I call. You're my go-to LSAT expert, so I appreciate all the nuance that you know about this process. And thank you for your time today.
I appreciate it. And I think, you know, the feeling's mutual. You're certainly the premier admissions consultant and consulting firm in this field. And you guys do an amazing job. And I just appreciate the fact that we have, you know, the relationship that we do where I can be like, hey, I have a question and you can do the same. And then we can complain about something else entirely.
And I'll see you post-COVID in person.
I hope so. You know, the last time I think we were together was the national championship game several years back. So maybe we can, round up again for the next one.
We'll tone it down a notch at post game.
You will. I won't.
Sounds good. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave. Always a pleasure.
Take care, Mike.